Lecture 10, Tyranny Overthrown, The Sons of Pisistratus.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. The tyrant is dead. Long live the tyrant. When Pisistratus died in 527, his sons took over the tyranny. This is perhaps another of his legacies, a dynasty. In this lecture, we're going to look at their rule, the fall of the tyranny at the hands of Sparta, and we're going to end with some comments about the tyranny overall. Now, Pisistratus was succeeded by his sons Hippias and Hipparchus in some form of joint rule. Hippias was the dominant one in the sense that he was in control of political affairs. He was the oldest, according to the Athenian constitution, as well as being more public-spirited and sensible. Hipparchus was apparently puerile. He was more interested in the arts and partying than public life. So he seems to have played more of a cultural role in the tyranny, perhaps akin to a minister of culture. And that probably suited where his interests lay anyway. These two sons, Hippias and Hipparchus, continued their father's economic policies and indeed extended them. They were responsible for developing the silver mines at Laurium, which was in southeast Attica. These mines would produce the silver for Athens's first state coinage, the famous owls, in about 525 BC. On one side of the coin was the head of Athena, and on the other side was her symbol, an owl, and next to it the first three letters of Athens, Alpha, Theta, Eta, to show where the coins came from. An official coinage was fundamental to any economy, and so the sons take great credit for how the economy was able to develop after their father's death. But these coins also had a propaganda function. Coins circulated so widely in the ancient world that they were a bit like a web page now or a URL. Everyone would connect these owls to Athens. What's more, the previous coinage that some Athenians had been using became obsolete with the rise of this new state coinage. So this further centralized the position of Athens in Attica. In foreign policy, thanks to worsening relations with Sparta in the Peloponnese, the sons fared less well. At some point, probably during their father's tyranny, the Alcmaeonidae family, which had become a real pain, was exiled. We saw that this family was exiled sometime after Cylon's coup in the 630s. But Solon had actually issued a general amnesty during his archonship, and this family, the Alcmaeonidae, returned to Athens at that time. Now, during the Pisistratid tyranny, it was in exile again. We're not sure whether it was one of those families that voluntarily left into exile when Pisistratus seized power in 545 after the Battle of Pallene, or whether it was one of the families that he kicked out. Either way, it doesn't really matter because it wasn't in Athens anymore. But that family was intent on returning, and to this end, it would soon start to use Sparta to work towards bringing the tyranny to an end. Then in 514, out of the blue, Hipparchus was murdered by two men. Their names were Harmodius and Aristogiton. Now the motive for the assassination isn't known, and the Athenian constitution gets names confused, and it doesn't help by saying that it was political as well as personal. So let's have a look at what the Athenian constitution has to say about this murder, because it's important for the turning point that it was in the tyranny. First of all, the personal reason. One of Pisistratus' other sons, a chap called Thessalus, apparently fell in love with a young Athenian man called Harmodius, but he didn't get anywhere with him. Harmodius rejected his advances. The Athenian constitution that tells us about this has confused the name Thessalus with Hipparchus. So we're really talking about Hipparchus here lusting after Harmodius and getting nowhere. When Hipparchus was rejected, he got really angry about this, and he arranged for Harmodius' sister not to be a basket bearer in the procession that was part of the Panathenaea festival. Now, we talked about the Panathenaea last time, the major festival in honor of Athena. And part of that festival was a procession of young virgin girls carrying baskets of first fruits. It was a big honor. It was important. And so the implication of Hipparchus's act was that Harmodius's sister wasn't a virgin and so couldn't take part in this procession. Now, this was a big social affront. And to make matters worse, Hipparchus slandered Harmodius to all and sundry. So that caused Harmodius and his lover Aristogeiton, and obviously Aristogeiton would have been none too happy at somebody else coming on to his lover, that caused these two to plan to kill Hipparchus. And if you think soap operas are far-fetched, then they've got nothing on the Greeks. So now, the political element. The Athenian constitution has been telling us about this personal angle so far. But then it adds the detail that Harmodius and Aristogeiton had, quote, many supporters. Now, this may or may not mean anything. Perhaps Hipparchus had broken a few hearts around Athens. Perhaps he'd angered no small number of lovers if he'd had affairs with their other halves. But then the Athenian constitution says that Harmodius and Aristogeiton were waiting to attack Hippias by the Acropolis. Now, the Acropolis is where the Panathenaic procession, that's the procession that's part of the Panathenaea in honor of Athena, that's where it ended. It starts off in the Agora area and it ends by the Acropolis. Now, the Athenian constitution goes on to say that as they waited by Hippias, they saw one of their fellow conspirators chatting away to him. They thought he was betraying the conspiracy to Hippias, so they rushed to the part of the Agora where Hipparchus was, and they prematurely killed him. Now, when they'd done this, when they had murdered Hipparchus as he was about to start off the procession and Hippias would receive it by the Acropolis, when they had killed Hipparchus, Harmodius was killed on the spot. He was murdered on the spot. But Aristogeiton was captured and he was tortured to give up the names of the other conspirators. So you can see that we may have a political motivation to the conspiracy, that it was meant to end the tyranny. Otherwise, why would Hippias have been targeted for assassination for what seems to have been a personal matter that involved Hipparchus? As for Aristogeiton, he was tortured, as I said, and he was keen to end his life, which is no surprise. So he offered to betray more names if Hippias would shake his hand as a sign of good faith. When Hippias did this, Aristogeiton mocked him for shaking the hands of his brother's murderer. And Hippias went ballistic at that. He pulled out a dagger and stabbed Aristogeiton to death, which is precisely what Aristogeiton wanted. It would stop his torture. Now, there's no question that the assassination was a turning point in the Pisistratid tyranny. Gone was its benevolent nature from the days of Pisistratus, when everything seemed to be going so well, this apparent age of Kronos. After 514, in other words, after Hipparchus' assassination, Hippias' rule became very harsh. He executed a number of people that he suspected had a hand in his brother's murder. Moreover, he decided he was going to move out of the city. And so he began to build a fortified compound on Munichia, which is a hill that overlooks the Piraeus, the port of Athens. Now that's significant because that would allow him to get away easily if need be. He just needs to nip into the Piraeus, hop onto a ship, and boom, he was gone. Now the Alcmaeonidae re-enter the picture. It's impossible to know whether they had anything to do with Hipparchus's murder, but they certainly helped to bring down Hippias in 510, 4 years after his brother's assassination. How did they do this? Well, political exploitation of religion again. The Alcmaeonidae agreed to fund the rebuilding of the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. This is the major oracular site, if you like, on the Greek mainland. It was where Apollo lived. The temple had burned down some time ago, but for some reason the people of Delphi had not rebuilt it. Rebuilding temples wasn't cheap anyway, but this is surprising. I mentioned before that the oracle at Delphi was now in the hands of the Amphictyonic League, those states that lived in and around Delphi. They administered it now. This was after the First Sacred War. So why didn't these states chip in and rebuild the temple? We just don't know. Nevertheless, the temple had not been rebuilt. And so the family, that's the Alcmaeonidae, now saw this as a way of gaining leverage over the priestess, the Pythia, the priestess of Apollo, because they offered to rebuild it. Now, the Alcmaeonidae was not doing this out of the goodness of its own pious heart, but for a more political reason. Rebuilding the temple, as I said, gave them leverage over the Pythia. And what they now arranged was that every time an embassy came from Sparta to consult the oracle of Apollo, the Pythia was going to add something to the answer. Didn't matter what the Spartans were consulting the oracle about, the Pythia was to add something at the end of every answer. And that something was, Sparta must liberate Athens from the tyranny. Now, this is similar to Cato ending every speech in the Roman Senate with Carthage must be destroyed. Delendo est Carthago. You see, you get some Latin in this course as well. Eventually, people would have got sick of hearing the same thing over and over again. It's like a broken record. The Romans got sick of this because to shut Cato up, they invaded Carthage. They destroyed the place. Remember at the end of the Third Punic War, 146 BC, I think it was, they destroyed Carthage and they sowed salt into the ground to make the ground infertile. They might have done this, they might not. It's a story that we've got to take with a pinch of salt. That's a joke. If you didn't get it, don't worry, nor do my students. But the Spartans also got tired of the same answer over and over again. And so to shut the Pythia up, they decided they were going to march on Athens. Another reason was that Athens had a growing friendship with Argos in the northeast Peloponnese. And we know just how much the Spartans were at loggerheads with the Argives. So by now in 510, the Peloponnesian League, that's a league that the Spartans had put together and that we're going to discuss when we move to Sparta in this course, that Peloponnesian League was up and running. And although Sparta was starting to become a player in Peloponnesian politics, Argos was not a member of the Peloponnesian League, and it still continued to dominate much of the northeastern part of the Peloponnese. It was always a danger then to Spartan growth in the Peloponnese. So there was a political reason then for marching on Athens, and that was to try to end the alliance between Athens and Argos. So in 510, an initial Spartan expedition was sent by sea, but it was thwarted by the Athenians. The Athenians were assisted by 1,000 cavalry from Thessaly, an area that was to the north of Boeotia. Thessalians, by the way, were an ethne. They didn't live in this polis system. Now, this Spartan reversal caused the Spartans to send in King Cleomenes at the head of a substantial force. So an initial Spartan reversal was met by more numbers. Cleomenes marched through the isthmus to Megara on the borders of Attica. He defeated the Thessalians who were trying to stop him entering Attica, and then he marched on Athens and besieged Hippias and his sons on the Acropolis. Now, when Hippias tried to smuggle his sons out of Attica, they were caught, and so he surrendered immediately to ensure their safety. He agreed to leave Attica within 5 days, and he did so. He actually went to Sigeum up in the Troad region. And so ends the Pisistratid tyranny in 510. It's important to note that it was a Spartan force, ultimately at the instigation of an exiled aristocratic family, that brought about an end to the tyranny. In other words, the ordinary Athenians didn't bring about the end of the tyranny. They didn't topple Hippias. Now, you might be thinking, well, how could they anyway? In the last lecture, didn't we say that Pisistratus had disarmed the people precisely because he didn't want to rise against him? He had a mercenary bodyguard too, and presumably that mercenary bodyguard continued to look after Hippias after his brother's assassination. In fact, we can imagine he doubled it. Well, there was only one of him. There was only one Hippias and one group of gods. And there was a lot of ordinary Athenian people. So ultimately, the numbers had to have been in their favour anyway. That would have been the case against Pisistratus as well. But the people never tried to depose Pisistratus, nor did they Hippias. And to me, this indicates that they accepted the rule of the Pisistratids because of the benefits it brought. And they accepted this despite the fact that any political experience they'd been gaining in the assembly was curtailed. I mean, after all, the assembly didn't meet under a tyranny. And they accepted the rule of the Pisistratids even after 514, when Hippias was ruling harshly. Incidentally, Harmodius and Aristogiton, that's the two who murdered Hipparchus, that deed, their assassination of Hipparchus, undergoes a radical transformation in the democracy that follows. The two of them become known as tyrant slayers, and in the restoration of democracy that follows the tyranny, all sorts of songs were written about them. And there was even a statue cast of them in bronze. And it was set up, probably in the Agora, to symbolize their valiant act in ending the tyranny. One of the drinking songs, or scholia as they're called, has the following lines in it. Here we go, I'm quoting now. "I will carry my sword in a bough of myrtle, the way Harmodius and Aristogiton did when they murdered the tyrants and restored equality before the laws to Athens." Let's not forget, though. Let's step back a minute. Harmodius and Aristogiton in 514 did not kill both tyrants. They only killed Hipparchus. They didn't end the tyranny, because it lasted for another 4 years until the Spartans toppled it. We've got a nice distortion of history here. Obviously, the scholion, the drinking song, was to praise democracy. The praise of Harmodius and Aristogiton was to highlight how important democracy was. That's what the Athenians believed in more than anything else. Mention oligarchy to them and they turn white. So Harmodius and Aristogiton's deed was made into something that it wasn't, for this patriotic effect even. Another side, perhaps, another explanation, is perhaps the Athenians wanted to downplay the role that their enemy Sparta went to in ending the tyranny. In other words, they rewrote history because they didn't want to be seen as the Spartans bringing down the tyranny. Let me now make some concluding comments about the Pisistratid tyranny overall and its place in Athenian history. We can applaud Pisistratus and his sons for how they benefited the city economically. We can applaud them for their patronage of the arts. And certainly they were cultured and lovers of arts themselves. Remember, Hipparchus was described as philomousos. But appearance was very different from reality. Was Pisistratus really this conscious social and economic reformer who became tyrant because he genuinely wanted to help the people, because he genuinely wanted to alleviate their sufferings? Or did he cynically exploit this situation, cynically exploit the faction fighting that was going on, the popular discontent, so that he could grab power and do what he wanted to do as tyrant? As much as I like Pisistratus, and I really do. If I had a time machine, I would go back to Pisistratus at Athens. No question about it. Well, I would go back to Pisistratus at Athens before 514. So as much as I like Pisistratus, I have to go with the latter one, the cynical exploitation. We mustn't forget that Pisistratus came to power by defeating the army of the Eupatridae, who were then in control of Athens. This was at the Battle of Pallene in 545. He marched on Athens at the head of a mercenary army. Afterwards, when he had actually seized Athens, he maintained his power by expelling any noble family that opposed him. And several hundred of these went into exile. Some would have done so voluntarily, saying, "We don't want to stay here anymore." Others he exiled. Those families that chose to stay, that in other words, he allowed to stay, he still muzzled them, he still controlled them, because he took as hostages their sons, and he deposited them with his friend and ally, Lygdamis, the tyrant of Naxos. He'd actually just helped Lygdamis become tyrant at Naxos, so Lygdamis owed him. It's kind of interesting, actually, that Lygdamis in turn supported a chap called Polycrates, who became tyrant of the island of Samos. So that meant that Pisistratus was part of a support network of tyrant alliances, rather than being allies with other polis, which would be more normal. Another polis, for example, wouldn't come to the aid of a tyrant, but another tyrant would. So Pisistratus knew what he was. He knew that if he ever needed help, he would need other tyrants to support him. And so he made his network of alliances very carefully. Remember also that he disarmed the people to try at least to offset any opposition to him. He took the people's arms and he locked them away. And he went everywhere with his own private mercenary bodyguard. This bodyguard he paid for himself. It was made up of Scythian archers, and he probably hired these during his exile. He was in Thrace for quite some time. He would have come into contact with the Scythians. These Scythian archers are depicted on pottery of this period, and they're shown by their very colourful and elaborate cloaks. And it's rather interesting that after the tyranny was deposed, the Scythian archers remained in the city, and eventually they became part of a force that defended the city's walls during the classical period. Obviously, not the original Scythian archers. We're talking about sons, grandsons, and so on and so forth. And here's another interesting thing. The sons of the hostages that were deposited with Lygdamis. What happened to them? We don't know. They disappear from history. This is a sort of Twilight Zone moment. Did they come back to Athens? Did they die on Naxos? We just don't know. Anyway, Pisistratus took measures to ensure that opposition to him was minimal and that his person was protected at all times. So he knew how he had come to power, and he had to make sure he maintained that power by muzzling the people. While he did not abolish the Solonian constitution, he did put it on the back burner. For example, he held archon elections, but he controlled them to ensure that his own supporters were elected. The assembly and the boule didn't meet. That meant that any political experience that the people had started to gain in the assembly, or even in the boule, as Solon had planned, was curtailed during the tyranny. The Pisistratids could not afford the assembly to meet, obviously, and they took steps to ensure that the mass of people stayed out of Athens. This introduction of the deme or town justices is an example of that. Yes, it enhanced the legal rights of the people, because now justice was taken to the people. But at the same time, it was a means of keeping the people on their farms, out of the city. So too were his loans to the farmers to help them through the period that it took the olive trees to mature. The Athenian constitution notes this. It says that Pisistratus' purpose in olives and deemed judges was twofold. One was to help the people survive and to keep them in the countryside where they would be busy with their own affairs and so not have the time to worry about getting involved in public ones. In other words, political affairs. Now, this view is very much a later one. It's very much a 4th century one, the time when the Athenian constitution was written. In the 320s BC, Greek autonomy was no more. Greece was now part of the Macedonian Empire. So the author of this work, the Athenian constitution, can look back on the entire sweep of Athenian history, and he can make these sorts of judgments and what have you with the benefit of hindsight. Remember also that the Athenian constitution was a product of Aristotle's school. And Aristotle has very strong views on the role of the people in a democracy. He doesn't think they should have one. He says in a number of his works that the best place for the people was working their lands. For example, in the Politics, he writes, and I quote here, "The best type of citizen body is agricultural, for owing to its not having much property, it lacks leisure, so that it is unable frequently to attend the assembly." So Pisistratus' measures were meant to muzzle the political power of the people. They were meant to keep them on their land, and so too busy to worry about political affairs. Aristotle would have approved then of Pisistratus. And this gets me to another of my heretical thoughts, and I foreshadowed this at the end of the last lecture. Perhaps this is why the Athenian constitution calls Pisistratus' tyranny a golden age. The phrase has got nothing to do with peace and prosperity or the first official text of Homer. It's used because the Athenian constitution can look back on Athenian history. It's written at a time when the people have been sovereign in the state under what was called radical democracy. And that type of democracy has been a disaster for Athens. It's the radical democracy that leads to Athens' defeat in the Peloponnesian War. Therefore, for the Athenian constitution, what makes Pisistratus' rule a golden age is that the people were not sovereign in the state, that Pisistratus had taken measures to muzzle their political power. Now, at the heart of Pisistratus' policies was the increased centralization of Athens in Attica. This was only possible by combating the influence of the aristocrats in the various areas of Attica, and his exploitation of religion was meant to achieve just that. We talked about his favoring of Pan-Athenian cults. We talked about the creation of the Dionysia, a festival in honor of Dionysius, the people's god. And it was what he did with these festivals too that would have endeared him to the people. The Romans had this expression, panem et circenses, bread and circuses. That meant that if the people were kept happy with free food and entertainment, they wouldn't kick up a fuss. Pisistratus was the precursor of this Roman tradition, to call it that. Because while the people were in Athens at the festivals, remember they were only brought into Athens on his terms. The rest of the time they were on their lands. But while they were in Athens, they got to eat for free, they got to drink for free, and they got free entertainment. A rhapsodic contest, say at the Panathenaea, or tragedy at the Dionysia. They came to see firsthand how Pisistratus was promoting the grandeur and power of Athens. How would anybody want to change a regime like that? Why would the ordinary people want to try to bite the hand that feeds them. And that's why it wasn't them, but it was an exiled family and an opposing state that toppled the tyranny. So we can understand this. We can understand how the people reconciled themselves to Pisistratus' tyranny, even though the political advances that had been part of Solon's constitution, even though those advances were being curtailed. Nevertheless, the problems arise again. In 510, after Hippias was expelled from Athens, the cracked record begins again. Faction strife breaks out again. What Pisistratus had tried to do to end that faction strife in the various areas of Attica had failed. Once again, we have competition for that archonship, showing us again that the eponymous archonship was the most important of these three offices. When Hippias is deposed, we find that two people are competing for the archonship, a chap called Isagoras and a person called Cleisthenes, a member of the Alcmaeonid family. Well, to cut a long story short, Cleisthenes is going to emerge as the victor, and he's going to introduce legislation in 508 BC that will take Athens in a radically new direction as far as democracy goes. And we are going to be dealing with Cleisthenes and his democratic legislation in the next lecture. And we're also going to be considering why he, and not Solon, is sometimes called the father of democracy. Thank you very much.